Tobias Gwulf is a man of many talents. In addition to writing wonderful short stories, a dose of gamma radiation in the 1970s caused Tobias Gwulf to obtain X-ray vision, the powers of invisibility, and an ability to see beyond the narrative of time. Tobias Gwulf has the strength of 100 men, the wisdom of 1,000 fractious governments, and has even managed to find a workaround for the third law of thermodynamics. Do not underestimate Tobias Gwulf. It is quite possible he may growl at you if you disagree. Okay, so I am here with Tobias Gwulf, who is most recently the author of Our Story Begins. Tobias, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks.
First off, I wanted to actually ask you about something you do with your first-person stories that I was fascinated by.
Uh-huh.
They don't really seem like first-person because they seem almost like close third-person or removed first-person because you tend to basically not use the word I so much. I mean, this is very evident, in, for example, in Flyboys, and I was curious about how this came about. You generally have your narrators often offer a sense of description and a sense of locale and a sense of other people as opposed to themselves, and I was wondering about this.
I don't know that that's so unusual with first-person narration. It certainly is different from a therapy session, and probably I would find a therapy session pretty boring for that reason. I'm just trying to think about the stories. I think of, for example, the opening of a story called Next Door. I wake up afraid. My wife is sitting on the edge of the bed, shaking me. They're at it again, she says. If there's something unconventional about my use of the third person, I'm not sure just what it is.
Maybe this is more of a classical sense of the short story versus the more contemporary short stories, which are, as you point out, more of a gushing therapy session. Maybe that's really what we're talking about.
Well, I don't know. I think, when I think, for example, of Philip Roth's first-person narrators, they're interested in the world at least as much as they are in themselves, interested in other people, and that shows up in the narration. It would be a pretty boring story that was so, if I can put it this way, kind of narcissistically defined that you didn't get a sense of the world beyond the narrator or of other people beyond it. I would think that unless it was deliberately taking on the pathology of narcissism, it would be a deficiency in the story.
Mm, okay, fair enough.
And also, I mean, you know, some stories, of course, some first-person stories rely on the very heavily colloquial, and that may be something that you're noticing is that whereas some of the stories, like the one I just quoted from Next Door, is quite colloquial. In other stories, you get a sense that the narrator is telling the story not in the immediate moment of the story, but perhaps from a distance, which also would give you a wider vision of the circumstances and the people involved, and also a more articulate voice, a more capacious voice. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it isn't just, say, the Catcher in the Rye kind of moment-by-moment narration, but something that would open up a little more in the way of Philip Roth or William Trevor, you know, way their first-person stories work.
I'm wondering if it's something similar to Nabokov's idea that he had to know the lay of the land before he could write any particular novel or short story or whatnot. Maybe this is sort of your kind of concern.
Well, by the
here.
Time I write the last draft of a story, and when Nabokov wrote his first drafts, they were like the last drafts of anybody else's. By the time I write the last draft of the story, I certainly do know, you know, more than I can ever tell about my characters and the situations, and so you're just seeing, a part of it.
I wanted to ask you about the use of very subtle symbols throughout these stories. I mean, they are essentially very straightforward realism. But you have, for example, in A White Bible, the attention to Frontage Road. You have the light shutting off at the end of Say Yes. And also, I really love the Thule fog at the end of The Rich Brother. So these are really symbolic, but also at the same time they come from this realism. And I should also observe that, particularly for these endings, it's often when you have a very concise story that these symbols pop up like this. And I'm wondering if you are writing a more concise or a shorter short story, that you need to have more symbolic heft along these lines? Maybe you could talk about this.
Well, they're not, I think they're not symbols in the way that a high school English teacher teaches symbols. They are features of the story that a writer that a reader can probably sense some consequence from without, I think, being able to define it. And at the end of The Rich Brother, Pete's in a bit of a fog, but it's also a very real fog. I mean, if you drive through that valley in California, the Central Valley, that time of night, you're going to be in fog. And so what symbolism there is the symbol is simply what life itself gives us. And, I mean, we actually navigate our lives by symbols, by the outward signs that lead us in one direction or another. Nature is filled with these things. And of course, writers make use of them.
Yeah. Well, in terms of endings, I think also Powder and Say Yes, which have endings before the endings, in the sense that we think it's going to end at a particular point, but in fact it ends before that point. And we are then left to sort of speculate upon where these characters are going. Mm-hmm. And again, this supports the theory I'm throwing out at you, that these conciser stories have more going on, or that need to be stopped either in intervals, or need to have more seeming symbols. I mean, maybe you could talk about this as well, the ending before the ending. And I mean, is a short story, when you work on that in terms of the concision process, I'm wondering if things like intervals are also a factor here, as opposed to letting something play out, you have to sort of chop something off at the end.
Well, the ending of a story, I think, should contain within it all that a reader needs to have an intuition of how the story might continue. And it shouldn't necessarily spell those things out, though some writers do. Tolstoy, for example, writes short stories as if they were novels. Yeah. And but to make a contrast, Chekhov draws enough of an arc that you imaginatively kind of complete the circle yourself. You're given all you need to do that. And my own practice as a short story writer has tended to gravitate toward that. I like, one of the things I like about the story form is how much it can imply. And not as a kind of guessing game or some cute little riddle you're playing on the reader, but in the way that situations in life imply other situations. And I mean, we actually, in our daily lives, become quite adept at intuition, at teasing out the implications of present situations in order to get some sense of how the future might unfold. When we go out with a girl the first time, on a date, we're doing that. When we have our first week a new job, we're doing that. You know, all kinds of, meet a new friend, all, you know, we're just constantly in these sorts of it's a very natural kind of mental and emotional exercise that we do, and I try to find a way of expressing that in the forms of my stories. I don't close things down because they aren't closed down in life. Tolstoy, the way Tolstoy closes his stories down is he has his characters die at the end. Yeah. And that is a pretty neat way to do it. They're not going anywhere then. But, I don't, and I love his stories, but they aren't the kind of stories that I write.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I also, speaking of death, I wanted to ask you about Bullet to the Brain. One question I have had for years that I've been meaning to ask you is whether there was any specific sort of literary critic that you were perhaps attacking for this, or whether this was a general kind of effort on your part to find some shred of humanity within some calculating intellectual monster.
Yes. No, there was no particular critic I had in mind when I wrote that. I've actually, for better or worse, been treated pretty well by critics. But actually, those were aspects of myself that I was lampooning in there, a tendency to look on from a distance at certain situations, to when I hear certain language in play, especially the language of cliche, tired, worn out language, a kind of inward sneer that I feel myself developing. And so I was kind of holding up certain aspects of my own nature, and especially as it's developed through a life of using language and in a rarefied way, in a literary rarefied way, that other people don't use it. And also pointing out that writers, by this very life of theirs that does distance them from a certain kind of hurly-burly, can become dangerously detached from reality. I mean, he has no sense. I mean, for all his sense of superiority, he actually has no sense of reality. Yeah. He doesn't understand what is happening. And he doesn't understand the relationship between power and language, and that it is the man with a gun who will decide what the language of the day will be, right?
Yeah. Well, it's also this sense of control he has. He thinks he has control over this environment when, in fact, he doesn't. Like, it's just like the professor in a mature student. I found this to be a similar theme story about this guy who has no clue that he's having this tremendous effect on this person as he shares the cigarette with
her. Yeah, yeah.
And this likewise seems to be almost, in fact, there a lot of the later stories seem to me replaying of earlier themes. I got the sense also with the dog's story as well.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean that you're almost revisiting these things with about a few decades down the line.
What themes? What?
Well, like for example, the whole notion of the dog attack in Her Dog, that is also played out in The Chain. I got a sort of similar sort of sense of revisitation, and I also saw
interesting. Well, there is no dog attack though in Her Dog. There's only the sense that that the character John has, that there might be one. And in fact, that this guy lets his dog off the leash, and the dog, I mean, dogs do that. They want to investigate each other. And what you see there actually is the anxiety of the character John not to lose this last vestige he has of his wife. And that, you know, he finds the dog's behavior threatening. The owner seems to think that it's quite normal, and you would expect that the owner would be a little more worried if his dog actually were savage. So this is a very different kind of situation, it seems to me, than the one in The Chain, where a child actually is attacked.
Yeah. Well, I also wanted to ask you about, I was reading these stories, and it struck me that a good deal of them involve cars or conversations in cars. And there's also a number of passages I found, a White Bible, The Rich Brother, Desert Breakdown 1968, Hunters in the Snow. These are all car conversations.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Confessionals, see.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
It's maybe the modern confessional.
Yeah, but it's also evident in your prose, because one of your stories begins, getting from La Jolla to Ala Vista State Hospital isn't easy unless you have a car or a breakdown. And then in the night in question, you write, Benny, he came out in high gear and never shifted down. So I have to ask you about this particular concern for cars on your point. Is it something that you
feel?
Well,
I think it's the country. I mean, you know, Faulkner had his yacht in Petoffa County, and the rest of us have cars that we live in now. I mean, when I was growing up, I traveled all over this country with my mother, and we lived in, you know, we slept in automobiles sometimes. So it's perhaps not unnatural for me to think of this as a kind of terrain for stories. But it's also, I think the automobile is the modern confessional. People disclose things that I think if they were sitting at a coffee table in a living room, they wouldn't. But there's something about the sense of motion and the sense you're not actually looking at each other, you're looking ahead, the cocoon-like quality of the automobile that admits of a kind of intimacy that I have found it convenient now and then in my stories to take advantage of.
Yeah,
there are there are probably four or five stories in this that make use of the automobile in this way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Desert Breakdown 1968 also seems to me a response in some way to The Grapes of Wrath. And I wanted to ask you if, essentially, it's almost as if we're talking about cars here. As opposed to a road novel, you're talking about a road short story, essentially.
Yeah, I did not have The Grapes of Wrath in mind when I wrote Desert Breakdown 1968, but that's an interesting comparison.
Well, I mean, what is it about the open road aside from this confessional aspect? Is it a matter of, are you going back to your audition?
It's possibility.
Yeah.
Especially in this country where, especially driving west as this character is doing, and Desert Breakdown 1968. You know, the sense of all possibilities being open at the end of the road that Americans have had really from the beginning of the country. So the road, as in, you know, Kerouac's novel, it has, and in The Grapes of Wrath, has a sense of hope and possibility about it. And certainly the character Mark in Desert Breakdown 1968 is on the road full of those very hopes.
I wanted to ask you about her dog and this uncommon consciousness of the dog in italics, which is unlike any other story in this and also very uncharacteristic of your realism. I'm wondering how this came about, this dwelling upon what the dog is thinking. I thought that to be quite intriguing because you just don't normally see that in your stories.
Well, do you have a dog?
Not right now.
Well, I think people have a sense that they are communicating with their dog sometimes. Clearly, though, the dog is not actually talking in this story. The real dialogue in the story is marked off by quotation marks. The exchange with the dog is the man having a conversation with himself. He's rehearsing his failures as a husband.
Yeah.
He's lost his wife. He's guilty about the conditions he put on their love in the form of the dog, what she could do if she got a dog, what she had to do with the dog, what her responsibilities were, where his were none. It's a kind of conditional love that he's realizing that he put on, imposed on their marriage, that is obviously a source of pain and remorse to him now. And the dog is all he has left of her at this moment. Mm-hmm. And that's why he reacts so violently to any threat to the dog. And what the story does here is take a dramatic form, rather than just have him thinking these things as in a completely realistic story, it pitches the man's argument with himself and his confrontation with what he feels to be his failures as a truly loving husband. I mean, we all have them to some extent, and creates those as a kind of conversation. And there's already been some sign in the story that he feels as if the dog talks to him when he picks him up. The dog squirms and he feels as if it's saying, put me down, which is quite plausible. That is, in effect, what the dog is saying. There are other moments like that that kind of prepare the ground for this later colloquy that they seem to be having. And so it really, it's a story. It's not a documentary.
Yeah.
And stories, I mean, you're right, I don't have any other talking dogs in my story, and I don't actually have a talking dog on this. The dog is talking in the narrator's, in the character's spirit, really, and he's not only all he has left of his wife, but he's also evidence in some ways of his narrowness and sometimes meanness as a husband, and so the dog's reproaches are actually self-reproaches in this story, but given a different kind of form in the story itself. I think most readers would know the dog's not really talking.
Well, this struck me because I'm very interested in your ending, as we've sort of established. But you often have an ending of a story that is a line or almost a murmur. I think of The Night in Question, Bullet in the Brain, The Other Miller. All of these end with an italicized line. And in fact, Smorgasbord ends in a particular whisper. So this seemed to me that you took the italicized end of the story and you made it the part, the whole hog of the story here. And I wanted to sort of ask you about this. I mean, we were establishing the intimacy in the car, but this idea of a susurration going off at the end of a story just is intriguing. I'm wondering how you first...
But that doesn't happen in Her Dog.
It doesn't happen in Her Dog, but it happens right in these other stories. And that's why I wanted to sort of ask you about, because I was really intrigued that this is a frequent way that you end your stories. Even though people come to the whisper from entirely different trajectories. That's what I'm
now. How many? Let's see. You're talking about the ending of
The Night in Question.
The Night in Question.
Bullet to the Brain, and the other Miller.
3 out of 31 stories.
Well, and there's also the whisper at the end of Smorgasbord as well. It ends with the
how this thing might
the
be
idea
done.
Of this murmur, and I'm curious as to how you first started dealing with this idea of a whisper closing a story.
Honestly, if it's something that comes up now and then, I don't mean to be coy, but it's just, you know, it's one, you know, okay, there are 4 out of 31 stories here that end with somebody saying something. So I don't know that is something that I could really talk about as a consciously developed technique. I don't have theories of narrative of that kind. I did when I was younger. As I write on in life, I find that each story will tell me in a way how it needs to be written. I don't bring a grid to the writing of the story or a theory of how stories are to be told, but I try to listen. This sounds mystical and mushy, but I try to pay attention to the story as it's as I'm writing it, and to try to let it come alive and to assume that form which is best for that story and the ending that's best for that story.
Okay, so what I'm getting at here is your narratives are largely intuitive, essentially, but I want to actually address your sentences on a basic sentence level, that you have a tendency to have a precise description, often with an imprecise detail. Like in A Mature Student, you have one sentence reading, "She was a tall woman with unruly red hair and a harsh accent of some kind." And then in The Benefit of the Doubt, you have a sentence that begins...
Well, yes, but this woman who is, through whose eyes we're seeing that description, wouldn't know what her accent was until finally she learns, as she does in the story, that the woman is from Czechoslovakia.
Yeah.
So that imprecise detail, she's as precise as she can be in her observation, but she isn't precise where she can't be precise.
Okay. But what about the other example I was going to get you about, The Benefit of the Doubt, where you have one of the ubiquitous Bangladeshi umbrella hustlers was working the corner?
Yeah.
And so this is very interesting to me because, first of all, it seduces me as a reader because I'm immediately struck by the hyper-specific detail, and yet we don't actually have this identity formed, the accent, which, of course, you later pay off. No. And in this case, this random hustler who just comes out of nowhere, and I wanted
you mean
to
add... the umbrella dealer.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, this is a guy who runs a kind of... who works for a kind of aid agency, spends a lot of time in Rome, speaks Italian, and so he would know that. He would know where these guys come from. I mean, I lived in Italy for a while, and I knew, you know, you knew what you knew after a while. And that's something he would know. That's not just an authorial detail dropped in there. That's the kind of thing he would know from his, as I mentioned earlier, he visits Rome quite a bit. And that's part of the atmosphere of the city. He's an alert guy. He travels a lot. That's his work. So, you know, there's a... There, the precision in the detail is again part of the person's character and their kind of way of facing life, you know, the kind of eye that they have on life. And it tells you, in some ways, a little bit about them. It kind of confirms the fact that he knows the terrain. But he is, you know, he is surprised by the situation he finds himself in on this day.
Yeah. Well, I also wanted to ask you whether this collection might have been larger, because I know that you did, in fact, write a story called Our Story Begins.
Yeah.
And it's in Back to the World.
Oh, I left a lot of stories out.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, what was the story selection process
well,
for this? Because this is almost the sort of the best of the greatest
this
hits.
This is the selected stories. And I wouldn't say the best of, because in fact, that story that I left out, I like a lot, our story begins. But in some ways, I thought that in its technique and in its feeling, it was rather close to another story in here. And I won't go into which one, but one of the principles of selection that I used was to avoid those things which seem to step too closely into the territory of another story. For example, I have a story set in a boarding school called Smokers that I like a lot. It was my first published story. It was in The Atlantic. I didn't use it because I have another story set in a boarding school in here that touches some of the same things. It's a different story, but I just wanted to visit that territory once in this story, and I had what I thought was a stronger story set in that territory that I used instead. And so, you know, things like that enter into it. Then some of the stories just simply didn't seem to me as strong as I wanted them to be. Mostly it had to do with the question of how harmonious they were with the stories that I really knew I wanted to use, how much variety they would produce in the collection within the kind of dominant chord of the music. And so, you know, and then again, you know, I hate to use the word again, but a certain intuition of which stories really belong best together.
How much did you sweat over
this? I left out
most
of the stories in my first two collections, though, and in putting this together.
I'm wondering how long you sweated over this. This almost sounds to me like you had this elaborate shuttle board where you were moving the chips around.
Yeah, it was definitely a labor of love, but it was a labor nevertheless sometimes to come up with a good design for the book in terms of the selections and the ordering and all that kind of thing. In the end, it probably doesn't make any difference because readers never read the stories in the order that short story writers organize them in. You know, we give a lot of thought to this. It's a very rare reader who will read a book from beginning to end.
I read this one from beginning to end.
Well,
so,
you're a rare reader, and you're a very, very good and very close reader, too, I can tell from your questions. And all the more rare for that as well. But I will confess that my tendency when I, say, pick up a new collection by William Trevor is to, I mean, he's still bitter about his school days. So I love the fact that this guy in his 80s is still pissed off about school and writing vengeful stories about school days. So I will look for, and I like those stories always, so I look for the one, there's usually one in the collection. I'll find that, I read that. Then, you know, if it's late at night, I'll pick a short one. Most readers read like that. They skip around a bit. Later on, when I've actually finished the entire collection, if it's a collection I really love, then I really will read it front to back. But in the first instance, I tend to skip around a bit. I think probably most readers do.
Yeah.
And therefore immediately defeat all that stuff you did when you were wringing your hands over what order to put them in.
There's one last question. I know you have to get going, but I have to ask you about another favorite story of mine, The Rich Brother.
Uh-huh.
This is interesting to me because essentially you're dealing with one brother who has made a good life for himself and his brother who has messed his life up. And the thing that I really admire about this story is the way in which you aren't overtly specifying to the reader with this ending, because there's a sort of implication reading this story. It's like, oh my God, you know, there's something involving care and there's something involving empathy for the misfits and the misunderstood in our society. And yet, we are sort of left from our reader Rorschach test to judge this man's last actions. And I wanted to ask you about this because it's a very delicate and tricky balance for any writer to pull off, but it's clear based off of some of the questions I've given you that you're not interested in analyzing the specifics. So instead of actually asking you about the specifics, I want to actually ask you more from a sort of from a design standpoint, how you wrestle with this notion of something that might be too explicit, something that's too spelled out, or possibly even a tad didactic.
Well, I mean, it's a good question, and I think writers are always vexed by. I mean, you can't write a story in a vacuum. You must have something that you're trying to convey, some emotion or some idea, to make it I mean, that wonderful line of Keats's when he said, you know, we resist poetry that has a palpable design on us. Well, he didn't say we resist poetry that it has a design on us. It's the palpable design. You don't want to see the strings attached to the writer's fingers. You don't want to see the thumb on the scale, do you? And I have to confess that even with a writer I love like Flannery O'Connor, I sometimes brace when I see the message coming, you know?
Yeah.
So part of, you know, they talk about the art that conceals art. There's also an art that conceals your design on the reader. You want it to affect the reader. You want it to affect the reader as you wish the reader to be affected. But you also know that if the reader sees it coming, it's all over. The game's up. So it really is a question of finding ways of being almost like a carnival gamesman where you engage the eye over here and are actually doing something over here for a moment. And in this story, for example, Donald is maddening. Most of the kind of responsible citizens like ourselves have somebody out there who drives us nuts that we have to keep coming back to and taking care of in some way or other. Sometimes that person is like that because they cannot come to terms with some of the things in life that maybe if we were really larger souls, we'd have a little more trouble coming to terms with than we do.
Yeah.
And, you know, Pierre in War and Peace is such a person. He kind of blunders through life. And his friend Andre gets exasperated with him, and his wife cheats on him. And there is something kind of exasperating about Pierre. But I love Pierre, and I sympathize with Donald. He wants to understand what this whole thing is about, and he doesn't really... he probably isn't really ever going to, but there's something a little fearless about him, and I like that. He's not careful. Pete, in his way, is. But Pete's also responsible, and he is also finally his brother's keeper. And so I wanted to get all that across, but without spelling it out so explicitly that the reader turns away with I don't know how to put it. I didn't want to make it overly explicit because I'm not writing an essay, I'm writing a story.
Yeah.
But there is a real difference there.
I'm wondering though, I mean, are you seem somewhat concerned with how the reader is going to detect the story or make out the story.
Sure.
Like for example, I read a review of this book in the San Francisco Chronicle, and it was interesting how that guy interpreted Hunters in the Snow, because I find that to be... It is funny. He thought it was a laugh riot. I think it's a very tragic story. So,
yeah, everybody reads. Listen, if you read, now there are a lot of reviews of this book out. And it's really interesting to me and very typical that you know, good readers, careful readers, one to another, will isolate a story and say, this is clearly the best story in the collection. The next reviewer will say they're all fine except for this story, and then they'll choose the one that the last reviewer singled out as the best. And it, you know, Edmund Wilson once said, "No two men read the same book," and that's true. I mean, we're not just clear lenses on these texts. Mm-hmm. We are cloudy, and we're clouded with our own subjectivities and memories and predispositions, and so. You know, yeah, I have my intentions for how these stories should be felt and received, but I also know that the minute I put them out in the world, the reader will make of them what he or she will. I mean, my control completely ends at that moment, and for that reason, I'm loath to offer interpretations of my own work because, first of all, I hate to direct a reader and how to read my story, and second of all, it wouldn't do any good anyway.
Yet you have tinkered around with the syntax in this, as you point out.
Oh, yeah,
note of the author. I mean, so there's still a part of you that is
perfecting
these things.
Oh, no, I have never stopped revising these stories since I wrote them. Since I wrote the first word of each of these stories, they have been in a continual state of you know, a journey in my own mind anyway towards some kind of perfection.
Yeah, gotcha.
Whatever a writer is capable of.
Tobias, it's a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you
so too.
Much.
You're a great reader.
Thanks.
You got me on.
Dark in the city and the night is a wire. Steam in the subway and the earth is a fire. Oh yeah.